Okay.
And I can't find papers.
Okay, if we are back on, I'm Colleen O'Neill, the Executive Director of Educator Preparation and Licensing. I am here to help answer some questions around item 16.05, which is the request from the University of Colorado Denver Aspire to teach for authorization to provide a teacher preparation program in the endorsement of early childhood education. So I just want to make myself available to answer any questions we might have.
Could you give
Joyce? I'm
going real fast because could you just give a little very brief summary of that program and when it came to us?
When it came forward.
Yeah.
So the Aspire program is actually a university or a CU Denver program, and it is the Alternative Educator Preparation Program. It was approved by the State Board of Education on August 8th, 2012. And at that time, it was approved for elementary education and all secondary endorsements, including special education. So today, or in the past month, what they did is they submitted for early childhood education for a program approval. So they are a designated agency that prepares our alternative educators across the state.
And did CDE evaluate what they've done so far and how that's worked before they added this additional early childhood?
That's a great question. Thank you for it. The authorization process is once every 5 years, and not more than once every 5 years for the authorization and evaluation of our educator preparation programs. Mm-hmm. But what we do evaluate is once a program comes forward with a new endorsement or a program, we absolutely evaluate the needs analysis. So we conduct a needs analysis. What program is it? Why is it viable in the state of Colorado or in the individuals that they're serving? We do, at a very high level, look at the performance that they have done over the course of the last several years. Because the reauthorization does not come up no more than once every 5 years, there's not a full and deep evaluation of the accountability around that.
Have we ever done an evaluation after 5 years, whatever fifth year that is, and said that this program is now either obsolete or doesn't do what it intended to initially?
Absolutely. We have evaluated, actually, in the last 6 or 7 years, we have evaluated multiple designated agency programs and either recommended deauthorization or disapproval of their content endorsement areas because they simply are not producing enough candidates or enough quality candidates, or they simply were not producing quality candidates that were entering into the education profession. And an example of that, I'm not coming up with a really good one off the top of my head, except for TFA, that actually used to be a designated agency for the state of Colorado and now partners with other individuals.
And do we have a list of all of those alternative licenses, teacher prep programs?
We do have a list of all of those designated agencies that are alternative educator preparation programs. Those are on our website, and actually we are updating the website right now, and I'm happy to say that there will be choice menus where educators can come in and say, I want to become an elementary teacher. I am located in the San Juan Valley. What kind of designated agency program or Institute of Higher Education could help me in that area? And so that will be rolling out soon, but that is all on our website, and it's a place that our educators can find that information.
Thank you very much. You answered all my questions.
Madam Chair.
Yep.
If I may, and Board Member Rankin, the topic you just broached is probably one of the most important that we will address the next 12 months. When I talked about those 9 traits, one of them is the very question you asked. The top performing countries know exactly to a T who the highest performers are in teacher preparation. Colorado is not unlike many other states where it is not a very rigorous or robust methodology. There's outside groups that have tried to do it, but I can't wait to work with Colleen because of her knowledge in this area to start to, we're going to bring ideas to you, and we would love your feedback also. The very best need to be preparing the very best. It's kind of a dumb way to say it, but it really is. And so we need to be able to evaluate, definitely not once every 5 years, and the bar needs to be very high around that. Colorado does have an interesting problem in that we are required to import a lot of our talent. And so we have been talking at length among the cabinet level of what's our role to help recruit teachers to Colorado, And just like I remember coming out of MBA school and Goldman Sachs and Intel, and they say, well, we only go to these six schools in the U.S. for 90% of our recruits, and we'll do these others for 10%. For our outside talent, we need to be proactive and say, hey, for our first effort to recruit teachers to Colorado to fill that gap, we need to be going to the very best schools in the United States to bring talent to Colorado. And then we need to make sure our internal schools are that very best talent also.
Thank you.
Thank you. So before we go on, I have to tell folks that after my cupcake got dumped, my name is Angel. Please change your records. That was what my mother was hoping for when she named me, because my name actually does mean little angel, but I'm not sure it turned out that way. All right, 1606.
Did that?
We need to take a vote.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, we do need a vote.
Do we get a motion?
It is on the consent agenda, the motion.
That's under a whole lot of icing right now.
Would you like me to read?
I
do
would.
Read that?
Sure. I'm serious.
Thank you. The motion on the table would be to approve University of Colorado Denver Aspire's request for authorization of teacher preparation program and the endorsement of early childhood education, item 8.01.
You're making that motion?
Sure.
Jane seconded it. Any objections? Okay, now we can go to relay.
Yep.
Am I right? Mm-hmm. Do I have a motion, by the way, for relay?
Not a motion just yet. We do have a
motion. We can have a motion and then discuss it.
A motion that we approve 1606. Mm-hmm. Should I read it?
Nah, it's okay. Jane, did you second it? It's the relay. Making the motion.
Pam seconded it.
Okay. Thank you, Pam. Okay, Val, do you want to start the discussion? This was one of the ones you pulled.
I don't know. I get so many emails about and then get stopped about this program. And then I get shown articles.
Could you speak into your mic?
Oh, sorry. And I get shown articles about the relay program. And it's I haven't heard a positive thing about it. So I'm wondering, why is it that we are supporting this program that, you know, is, I don't know, sounds terrible. And then somebody sent me, which I think I sent you too. I think I sent you that, or was it Engage? No, I think it was Relay.
I think it was Engage, the one with the kids in the classroom doing...
Yeah, that was Engage. That was Engage.
But then Relay is another one. So why? Maybe it's in Denver. Is it in Denver?
Colleen, do you want to give us some background that might be helpful,
absolutely.
Please?
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Schroeder. So Dr. Flores, the item before us, actually, there's multiple different variations of Relay. What we are actually looking at today is the Relay Graduate School of Education. And this is actually coming through the Department of Higher Education through us. So we concurrently, the Department of Higher Education and the Colorado Department of Higher Education, concurrently authorize programs for the Institutes of Higher Education, which Relay Graduate School of Education is seeking a post-bac approval from the Department of Higher Education for educator preparation. And as that process goes forward, what happens is the Colorado Department of Education looks only at the content for that higher education institution and then forwards it on to the Department of Higher Education. So our review authority and our statutory authority to review institutes of higher education and the educator preparation programs that go into them very much is only around content. And in order to do that, what we do is we amass a committee of individuals, both internal and external, that are knowledgeable about the content, and then we make sure that they are in alignment with our educator preparation and licensing rules and our Colorado academic standards. So what is before us today is really only the recommendation saying that the committee has come to the conclusion that the content that they produce, it has nothing to do with anything else about the Relay Graduate School, but the content that they are seeking to implement from a curricular standpoint is in alignment and appears to be in alignment with our Colorado academic standards and our standards for educator preparation and licensing. From here, what happens is then it goes to the Department of Higher Education, and they will have more conversation around the quality of program, the quality and rigor associated with that. Does that help at least clarify what's in front of us today and some of that, a little bit of the differentiation?
I haven't done the research fully on this. Am I right that this is part of the transformational centers for teacher preparation? They've identified five centers or five focus points, and this is one of them. It's a nationally funded through Gates, $34 million. Am I correct in that, or am I?
Dr. Scheffel, you're probably into areas that I am not very knowledgeable of, but we do have Katie Hawks, who is a representative and has been the lead planner for the Relay Graduate School with us today. Would it be okay to have her talk a little bit about it?
That'd be great. Like, what is its history? Who's behind it?
Please.
So we're actually going to have
some calls. Oh, okay. So we want some folks to call in? Okay. So we have some folks to call in.
Great, thank you.
From what I understand, the folks that will be able to call in and... please, Ms. Hawks, make sure that I get this right, is going to be Dean Hostetter and the Chief Research Officer, Dr. Billy Gastick. And I think they will help be able to answer some of our questions around this.
It's busy.
Welcome to the meeting
busy.
Conferencing service.
You're very funny today.
You are joining the conference room. You are the host. Access is immediate. For a menu of available prompts, press the star key, 6, and the pound key.
Is it good? Do we need
to do it? Hi, do we have...
Hi there. Do we happen to have Dean Hostetter and Chief Research Officer Dr. Gastick with us?
Yeah, hi, this is Mamie Hostetter.
Hi, Mamie. This is Colleen O'Neill from the Colorado Department of Education. How are you?
Well, thanks. Sorry, could you just say your name for me one more time?
You bet. It's Colleen O'Neill from the Department of Education in Colorado.
Kelly O'Neill. Nice to meet you, Kelly.
Thank you. You are on a conference phone in the State Education Board Room with all of our state board members and our Commissioner of Education, so you are on a conference line. And we do have a board member, Dr. Deborah Scheffel, that would like to ask a couple of questions. Are you available for questions at this time?
I am, absolutely. Thank
Perfect.
You all for your time.
Dr. Scheffel?
Thanks for talking with us. I was just looking at the press release from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation talking about the $34 million grants to improve teacher prep, and then, of course, the five transformation centers, one of which is Relay, through Teacher Squared. Can you talk about who funded you, what the basis of your program is, if you're for-profit or not-for-profit, how you hire your faculty, what your model is? I really don't know a lot about it.
Sure. Those are a lot of questions. Let me start with a little bit of history, and then I hope I can get us quickly to this recent Gates grant. So we started 8 years ago as a small program here in New York City, partnering with Hunter College, one of the city universities here in New York. And that work with Hunter garnered some attention from the state and the local school districts, and we applied to become our own institution of higher education here in New York in 2011 and received that approval. And we then went on to become accredited by both NCATE as a teacher preparation program, as well as Middle States Commission of Higher Education as an institution of higher ed here in New York. Since that time, 2011, 5 years ago, we have established campuses in Newark, New Jersey, as well as New Orleans and Houston and Chicago, and starting this year in Memphis and Delaware and Philadelphia as well. All nonprofit graduate schools of education focused exclusively on preparing teachers and school leaders, fully accredited in all of those states and regions. And our faculty are primarily clinical faculty, so people who were, all of our faculty were very strong K-12 classroom teachers. Several of our faculty then went on to either school leadership positions or doctoral preparation or work in education and in other fields. Many of our faculty are lifelong teachers. And that's the first and most important thing we look for when we look for a new faculty member, someone who is a great K-12 teacher, him or herself, and can help new teachers to become great teachers as well. The Gates Foundation grant was a recent victory. We are really excited about that work. We've been in informal collaboration with lots of institutions from our start. I mean, beginning with Hunter here in New York City, where the collaboration was more formal, but working with other organizations along the way, a learning to teach group, sort of a collaborative learning community with institutions like the University of Michigan and others. And I'm part of a group called Deans for Impact, and a number of deans of schools of education across the country, from Johns Hopkins to the University of Texas to Texas Tech, which was one of the other Gates Transformation Center winners. And so what we're really hoping to do with that work is to learn from institutions like those that I just named, and also share broadly with the teacher preparation community what it is that we're doing here at Relay, so that the whole field can get better faster for new teachers and principals. That is the short version, and I am happy to elaborate on any part of that. Just let me know what would be helpful.
And how many students do you currently have?
In New York, we currently have just short, shy of 1,000 graduate students. Across the entire country, we have about 1,500 graduate students. So our other campuses are much, much, much smaller than New York, and we'd be hoping to launch with a relatively modest campus in Denver next year, short of 100 graduate students.
Yeah, and so may I just refresh myself? Are we voting on this today, or is this just an information item?
Actually, I'd like to ask some questions.
Thank you. This is actually up for a vote today, or approval, basically, of the content only.
And have we seen it before?
No, I guess my concern is this is
a completely different model of teacher prep, and the entities that are part of this grant are Elevate, National Center for Teacher Residencies, Relay, of course, who we're talking with, Teaching Works, University Partnerships for the Renewal of. I mean, it's a completely different model. I would wonder how it affects our traditional universities, UNC, CU, DU. And I think it's great to have new models, and certainly their clinical focus is very helpful in teacher preparation. But I would need a lot more information about how they function, what their curriculum is. I mean, just because it's a completely different model. It's different when we have traditional universities following our state licensure standards, submit applications for new programs. This is a completely different model. So I guess I would leave it to others to ask additional questions about cost, type of faculty, and how this has affected teacher prep institutions. It strikes me that they have a fairly small program, but still looking to grow with a lot of money from Gates.
I will also remind us just very quickly that we have limited oversight over the educator preparation pedagogical standpoint of this. From a statutory authority position, we are charged with the content approval, and the Department of Higher Education, through the Colorado Commission of Higher Education, is actually charged with the authorization of this as a whole. So the next step, this is one single step to say, does the content align with our standards and our requirements in the Colorado Academic Standards? The answer from that, from a curricular standpoint of content only, has been yes for us. Now, as it goes on to the Department of Higher Education, many of the questions that you just asked, Dr. Shuffle, are definitely questions that are being asked holistically. And this is one of the somewhat nuanced differences between what we do in authorizing educator preparation institutions at institutions of higher education, certainly versus our designated agencies, where we have complete and total autonomy over and not driven by a statutory requirement in our Colorado revised statute.
So since this is a completely new model that would come into our state from an external entity, do we have the report on how you align the content, or did we not have that?
Yes, the matrices and the content was submitted with the Board of Education packet. And we're more than happy to answer additional questions around that. If we want to open up some of that documentation as well, we could take a look. It is in your packet.
It is. I'm not sure that it's in your packet.
I don't think I saw it either.
But it is on board docs.
It is on board docs.
It is on board docs.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to leave the person on the line.
Joyce? But I do want to ask a question.
Joyce was that? I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
I already called on her.
Well, okay. Dr. Shuffle, I just want to let it be known that I was curious about this program, too, and I met with Katie Hawks and the dean for at least an hour and a half last week, and my first questions were about the alignment of the curriculum and how it aligned with what we have here in Colorado. And I was assured that it was, because this is what they're going through here. As far, and they also explained some of their teaching techniques and what they do that's different than what we have in our regular. I love the innovation of it. I think that I like the idea that it's going to go to the colleges. I mean, they have some responsibility to see if what they're teaching is, I mean, we know it's aligned, but how do they teach it? And they have had success in other states. And again, we can, in 5 years, you know, review it and just see. I mean, it's not something that's forever, but I'm encouraged by any innovation that it looks like they've done their homework and is ready to go with the program, as long as the colleges have accepted it.
Yes, I'd like to look more deeply at its alignment with research and other things, which I haven't seen the documents.
How long is the program for? I think it's for teachers, and it's also for administrators.
This particular program that's in front of us today, Dr. Flores, is only for teachers. This is actually a two-year post-bac program. So all of these folks are already coming to the program with a graduate or a bachelor's degree in some way or another. And then it's actually a two-year program. The first year of that program, these individuals are partnered with a mentor teacher. They are not teachers of record. They are mentor teachers in the classroom. And so they go through their courses and they work in the classroom with their mentor teachers. The second year of the program, then they are actually teachers of record and continue on with the support programs through the remainder of their two-year experience. And that's really their master's level. So they graduate from this, again, Institute of Higher Education graduate level program that also gives them an educator preparation program so that they can obtain licensure at the end with a master's degree. So it is a two-year program, as it is stated today in their application.
And how much does it cost?
I apologize. I don't have an answer for that.
It's not relevant.
Katie Hawks will
I can share that if it's helpful.
Oh. Or Dean Hostetter. And either way.
And yeah, happy to help. It's $17,500 for the full 2 years. But because we are fully accredited, students are eligible to apply for federal financial aid. And many of our students, by virtue of the schools that they're choosing to work in, are also eligible for AmeriCorps grants of $11,000 over those 2 years. So the average out-of-pocket price per graduate student is somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000 total over the course of the 2 years.
And is there travel involved since you're in New York?
So one of our campuses, and our main campus is here in New York, and I'm the dean of this campus here. There's another dean who I manage directly who would be starting our Colorado campus. She lives in Denver, and the only reason that I'm on the phone today instead of her is because she's taking her comprehensive exams for her doctoral coursework.
So to a little bit enhance that a little bit, so a requirement of the Department of Higher Education is that they have a physical presence in the state of Colorado. So they are establishing that or have established that. Ms. Hawks has been here for a little bit over a year as a planner in the state, and then they will establish their physical presence as part of the Department of Higher Education's review authority.
So a question. How is the experience significantly different from the PEBC Betcher program, where you work with a mentor, you're in a classroom? I mean, I don't know. Is this significantly innovatively different? Sorry, I put you on the spot, but
that's okay.
No,
Dean Hostetter, would you like to answer that question?
Directed to me?
Please go ahead.
I'm sorry to ask, but could the speaker ask it one more time and a little bit closer to the microphone?
Sure. I was asking, and I was actually asking an individual here in the room behind you about how this is significantly different from the alternative program that we already have, that it's called the Betcher Residency Program.
So, Dean Hostetter, I actually think this is a conversation that Dr. Karen Martinez, who is our resident senior consultant in educator preparation, can help us answer with regard to how is the residency model different. So I would invite Dr. Martinez to join us.
Great. Thanks,
sorry, Dr. Karen. I did not remember. I don't know your new name.
No worries. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Karen Lowenstein-Martinez, and I'm the Senior Consultant for Educator Preparation here at the Colorado Department of Ed.
And there are parallels between the two, I would say.
That's what I read.
Both are in partnership with schools at a systemic level in order to select teachers who are right for that particular context. What I see as potentially a difference is that in the Better Teachers program, the residents are matched with a mentor for an entire year, and I think that Relay's residents have actually multiple teachers with whom they will travel over the course of the year in order to see multiple models of practice.
Okay.
They are very similar in that they are post-bac licensure programs partnering with or as an institution of so this is an institution of higher ed. It's a master's degree as well, so that's similar.
Okay. So this is not significantly different, except that they're probably going to graduate ultimately a larger number of...
I'm sorry, Dr. Shorter, who is the...
Relay. Is like, I mean, Betcher's not likely to grow significantly to the same extent than what you see in New York.
And these are scholarship kids.
I think that both programs are in partnership with the field such that they grow according to the needs of
the
field.
The field.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So this is not that unusual for Colorado to have a program. It's not the same, but it certainly does align.
Yes.
And that was what I thought when I was reading about it, that it was...
That's correct.
And another alternative program. For clarity's sake, Dr. Flores and Dr. Scheffel were speaking a little bit probably about the curriculum in and of itself and the differences in the curriculum that are different. They are definitely a different approach than what you would see in a traditional Institute of Higher Education model. So, and again, those are the things that I think everybody was kind of talking a little bit about. But the residency piece itself, very similar in structure.
Okay. So we have a motion on the table. Should we call a vote? Busy.
Board Member Flores?
No.
Board Member Goff?
Aye.
Board Member Mazanek?
No.
Just one. When we made the motion, you had seconded it. I don't know.
So now I have to say yes?
I don't know.
No.
Okay.
It doesn't.
No. Okay. Great. Board Member Rankin?
Yes.
Board Member Scheffel?
No.
Vice Chairman Schroeder?
Yes.
Well, tricky.
So,
we have a tie.
So
they will talk about a point of order around seconding and then voting. I've been told just the opposite at these meetings.
Can you help us out at all, Tony?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have a copy of Robert's Rules with me.
Busy does.
So
Steve knows it,
and Steve memorized
does know
it.
Time to come back, I tell you.
Yeah. Well, your name was next on the vote for the Relay School.
Oh. And Mr. Durham, the question that has arisen is whether somebody who seconded the motion could then vote against the motion.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
That's what I thought it was.
I'm just telling you what happened.
Are you still in the middle of a roll call?
Yep.
You just walked
we
out.
Are.
Okay, and it's the motion was?
To approve.
Taking off consent.
Relay.
It's 3-3.
Excuse me. I don't think you've heard the discussion, though. I mean, is it appropriate for him to vote, having not been here for the discussion?
No. Can you call for, and this, Chairman Durham, I'm sorry to intrude, and this is probably Tony's question, too. Can you call for additional information if it were not involved in the conversation? So it is an even vote at this point in time, in full transparency. You would be the deciding factor in that vote without the information that that was given previously. I don't know, and I don't have Robert's Rules of Order sitting in front of me. Mr. Dill, do you have any recommendations on whether they can, what the next process is so that it's an equitable process?
I actually believe that my recommendation at this point may be to hold this over and take it up again tomorrow, giving Chairman Durham time to familiarize himself with the issues involved.
Mary,
would that work?
Procedurally, it's not appropriate to interrupt a vote, and I did come in, and I should have gone back to the office.
Uh-huh.
But perhaps the easiest way to do this is if I cast a no vote, I would be on the prevailing side and could move to reconsider that issue then tomorrow or... Let's see what would be that might work. Or I could abstain. Let's see here.
That gets us nine.
Let's see.
Lots of negatives from the field.
Pardon me. Okay, why don't we... let's see. Yeah. Can I leave again?
No.
Yeah. All right. Chair will vote no, and we'll give notice of intent to reconsider tomorrow.
And Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair now, just to be clear, as far as procedure goes, you can pop in to vote anytime.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's the best legislative practice we ever did as lawmakers, but you definitely can swing in. And
the exception is if you're a quasi-judicial matter where you needed to have heard the testimony.
Right.
So, all right, I apologize for being absent. And so that motion is lost on vote 4-3.
And just to be clear, for those who don't have the legislative background, like Mr. Durnbaugh said, that allows him to reconsider it, bring it up, because he was on that prevailing side. So,
yeah. A little reminder, this is not legislative.
First and second, like you were talking about, first and second votes on motions.
In some of the context that we've all worked in, maybe the variety of them, some at places it's accepted where someone can just come in and sort of cafe vote. If they haven't been a part of the conversation, it's one thing. We don't typically accept a practice of voting. I think we've only been specific about it on phone meetings, phone situations, or electronic situations. We don't give anybody the prerogative of voting if they have not been online for the whole context of that discussion.
Mr. Chair, there's culture versus they had asked what's allowed. And I apologize because the rules allow it, but culture, you're saying, does not.
Yeah, I think
culture and specific.
I think Ms. Goff, that part of the problem and the reason I did vote, it dies either way on a 3-3 tie or a 4-3. So the motion, whatever the motion was, would not prevail under either circumstance. And I think part of the problem is, as a general rule, a member who's present is required to vote. And in parliamentary procedure, unless you're, I don't know whether I could have been allowed to abstain, I would have to go back and look at that. So I apologize for the inconvenience, but it leaves us in the same position as if I had not voted.
Yeah,
the motion did not pass, and I voted.
I don't want to belabor this. We've all got things to do. What's the difference between... having a tied vote that went against a tied no situation, which means a tied vote, which means the motion fails, and it still could have been brought back tomorrow to be revisited.
There is a body of evidence that says that a tie vote, there is no prevailing side, so it does make a difference.
Well.
But Mr. Herman, when you walked in the room, though, that's what triggered. He's not allowed to. He's not allowed to abstain. He had to vote. The parliamentary rules are he had to vote once he walked in the room.
Let that be a lesson.
Yeah. And I won't do that again. So.
And another thing, I just wanted to just add that. May I?
As long as we know.
May I just add that I wished we had gotten information on the program, even sites to go and look at. I just didn't have time. But I might have had time if I had had a site, or maybe I had 3 pages of it that I could read. But I didn't, I don't remember having anything.
Board Member Flores, that was my fault because it was on the consent agenda and it was more of a table matrix. I did not have copies for you all, but everything is available on Board Docs. Okay. So it is accessible.
I need to learn how to use that.
Mm-hmm.
Can I, Board Docs? Before we leave this, in the interest of being prepared, does Relay, do they operate outside of only New York? Is it primarily New York City based? Is it the state of New York? Are there, she mentioned 1,000 students, that's, it could be a few states worth anyway. So where are they besides New York?
So right now, it sounds to me like they do primarily operate outside of New York. They are in New York. And right now, the vast majority of their students are about 1,000 students in New York. There are about 1,500 students. Let's try that number. I was an English teacher, not a math major. It is incredibly obvious. So, and it does sound like they are in New Jersey, Houston, Chicago, New Orleans, and then there is actually quite a cadre that they are working at moving into in other states, mostly large urban areas at this time.
Is there already an established sort of partner school or partner?
They're not.
Is it Get Smart Schools? Have they been?
That's a different designated agency.
Already in Colorado.
Get Smart is actually a different designated agency, but the lead planner, Katie Hawks, who is here, has been working with some other schools in the Denver metro area and has been developing partnerships with some of those individual schools.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. I'm falling totally apart. Thank you.
All right. So the next item I understand is the 1607. Is that correct, Ms. Birdsall?
Stay there.
I would love to talk about that.
Perfect. 1607, educator preference and preparation licensure rules.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Thank you very much. So just for the record, Colleen O'Neill, Educator Preparation and Licensing, Executive Director. I am here before you today. This is a couple of times that I've been in front of you to talk about the Educator Preparation and Licensing Rules. So the last time I was here, it was January, and we had just delivered kind of a draft version of the rules to you. We had gotten some Board of Education feedback. Specifically, Dr. Shuffle asked us about some literacy requirements in some endorsement and content areas across the educator preparation rules collectively. And I really appreciate the fact that she gave us that opportunity to investigate a little bit deeper, because it was in fact true that we were missing some of the literacy guidelines that we really needed to ensure that our educators were trained at the right level. For our elementary specifically, our reading teacher, our reading specialist, and our early childhood education, the only changes that have been made to the rules since the January edition to today were the inclusion of some specific literacy elements that really are necessary for our elementary reading specialist, reading teacher, and our early childhood education educators. So today I am back before you bringing the rules, the next draft of the rules to you for vote and for any additional questions or insight that you would like to give us at this time.
Yes. Do we have a motion?
I move to approve the updated revisions to the rules for the 1991 Educator Licensing Act.
Is there a second to that motion? It's been moved and seconded. Ms. Rankin was the second. So any questions about this particular item? Yes, Dr. Shuffle.
I just wanted to make a comment. I really appreciate your consideration of it, and I know it strikes me that this language allows universities to develop coursework which will render teachers, we're talking about teacher preparation here, ensuring that they have the kind of preparation that will subserve their success in the two areas where they're held highly accountable, math and reading. But this language allows universities to create courses that will have a better likelihood of making that happen. Without that, there was one word that referenced this really important area of literacy, the gateway skill to all the other areas. So I appreciate the consideration, reconsideration of it. I did a scan looking at other states that have very minimal language versus more delineated language, and we would be in the minority if we didn't add some specificity around this issue. So I think it helps teachers, if universities take it seriously, mm-hmm. and create great courses around this content. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Scheffel. Yes, Dr. Schroeder.
So I'm curious if that was necessary. Are there not standards and that around numeracy that we would want?
Thank you, Dr. Schroeder. There were actually some specific standards in numeracy that were outlined a little bit more clearly and diligently, and especially in our elementary education and then our math endorsement. There was not necessarily a complete like-to-like event for that. So, again, it really was something that I think it was missing.
And
the
I'm not going to suggest that we
That's
go
okay.
forward on that. But are you saying there was a math? Oh, you're talking about the math endorsement.
Right, the math endorsement.
The higher level.
Had okay. a little bit more depth than the literacy side of that math endorsement and the math criteria associated with it and the language around the use of numeracy, the use of number talks. I mean, just some more specificity around those endorsement areas than there was in the literacy that gave us a little bit deeper content for our still flexible. I do want to say that it's still flexible content for our educator preparation entities to go to ensure that their educators are graduating with the skills needed for our kids.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? It's been moved and seconded that we adopt the rules as presented and amended. Is that correct? Is there objection to the adoption of that motion? That motion is adopted by a vote of 7-0.
I just have to say thank you. I'm so sorry. Thank you guys so much for all of your insights and support. This has been since May of 2014. So thank you.
Are you suggesting that
from every educator preparation entity in the state and our kids, thank you.
You're welcome. But are you saying you're tired of showing up here every month?
No, because you're going to see me again in March and April and May, and this starts our next iteration of opportunities to enhance our educator preparation licensing rules.
Good.
We'll now, be delighted in a giddy to see way, you. I will exit so you can move on with your agenda.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are we now? We have time. Do we have time for the concurrent?
I don't know. So that's what I was wondering. I was just getting ready to email Gretchen and Misty because I wasn't sure how quickly we get through those.
Right.
So.
Oh, that's. We a might
question.
Do that. And hold.
Save that for tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll have to see what we have to hold over for tomorrow.
Okay.
Please.
Do we really need to
check
5 or can we go
a
question?
Oh, come on.
Are you supposed to be over there?
We'll try and make 5 o'clock, and we'll see how many we have signed up to testify.
You made a hole there. What did you do?
Okay, yeah. I retract.
Well, please. You ate the frosting, and then you put a little hole in it. I can't believe it. And then I did. Look at this. I did all of that. Yeah, but, you know, do this. No. Uh-oh. I hate that frosting. No.
See, we used to have one... one person signed up to testify, so let's try and do that real quick. Is looks like Ron Taylor. Yes, come in, ladies. Is there Ron Taylor here? Apparently we outlasted him, so public testimony is closed. Let's see if we can wrap up item 18.1, concurrent enrollment overview. Welcome, Gretchen.
Well, I am so glad to be here, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yes, and you said that very straight face. That's
I
good.
Did. I said that with full sincerity.
Thank you.
So I have Misty Ruthven with me today, who you all remember, I'm sure, who's the head of post-secondary here at CDE. And we've just prepared a kind of background and overview for you on concurrent enrollment at your request. As just a bit of background here, there are several bills flying around right now about concurrent enrollment, and so I think this is very likely to be something that there's legislation on this year. So at some point, you all in your legislative conversations may talk about some of those specific bills. And so this is meant to just offer you some background so that as you're hearing and considering those, you sort of know the full picture of how this works currently. So that's our goal today, is just to offer you some background. Feel free to interrupt with questions when you have them. But let's get started. Oh, I already just said that. That's the overview. Look how quick that can be. Oh, moving right on. So what is concurrent enrollment? So this is the definition from statute, which is pretty straightforward for us. Simultaneous enrollment of a qualified student in a local education provider and in one or more post-secondary courses, including academic or career and technical courses at an institution of higher education. So in plain language, what that means is a student enrolled in our public K-12 system who also is simultaneously taking courses at an institution of higher education. That could be a community college, that could be a four-year institution, it could be academic coursework, it could be career and tech coursework. That's the basic definition of concurrent enrollment. This is a map. That's obvious. I'm sorry. This is a map showing. Let me finish that sentence. We're all a little punchy here at the end of the day. This is a map showing participation in concurrent enrollment. So as you can see, you know, as you look across the state, and I know this has been a specific question you all have asked us before, you know, 94% of districts and 80% of high schools are participating in concurrent enrollment, which means they have one or more students who are enrolled in a course in a higher ed institution using the concurrent enrollment structure.
Gretchen, can you read this map?
No. No, not at all.
Just wondering.
It's meant for, like, graphic, you know, just for you to see the density.
The pink and the white.
Yes.
It's about pink and white. It's not about what district that is.
No, but we will have one later that is a little bit distinct, and it will be irritating, too, because it is also small. So I'm very
Thank
sorry.
Thank you. In your definition of concurrent enrollment, can you clarify whether a remediation course?
We are going to get to that in just a bit.
I'm done.
So hold it. Okay. Misty, I'm going to ask you to go through the next few slides here about just who's participating in proportions and whatnot.
Great. Thanks, Gretchen. So one thing that you had asked us to address in January as far as a concurrent enrollment overview is why some of the districts in the white color were not colored in and why they weren't participating. So we have reached out to all of those folks, and they've responded with three primary themes about why they're not participating. It's typically about geographic distribution, and they're not close or near a higher education partner, and they haven't figured out how to offer distance education for concurrent enrollment. The secondary piece is service area, which is in regulation for the Department of Higher Education, and it's something that the Lieutenant Governor has signaled that the Commission on Higher Education, with the Commission on Higher Education, that they are taking on to look at service areas, basically which institutions of higher education serve which school districts. It's really as simple as that.
Oh.
And the other piece is affordability connected with teacher credentialing. So do I have qualified teachers in my high school that can teach concurrent enrollment? The interesting part is we have offered technical assistance within our limited capacity to these folks to help work through some of their challenges around concurrent enrollment and especially on the access piece for finding other ways that they could look into concurrent enrollment, for example, in distance education. We have had a few districts in the past that have been non-participating districts that have then participated the next year, and the two primary pieces that they have cited is they have found a way to offer online courses for concurrent enrollment or have overcome some general affordability hurdles associated with concurrent enrollment. And we'll go into a little bit more of the financial models associated with concurrent enrollment.
Did you talk to them about tech, opportunities for tech concurrent enrollment? So if they don't have an institution of higher ed, are there other programs nearby that some of their students might want to participate in?
It's possible. We'll go through the delivery as far as online, in the classroom, or at the college options in just a second, if that's what you're asking.
Career and tech ed options still are offered by institutions of higher education, right? It
only,
still is a community college.
It's still only that.
Right. And so that geographical access is relevant for those courses as well.
Thanks.
Yep.
So as you can see, concurrent enrollment has been growing steadily since it was changed in 2009 in its current form, and we have phased out PSEO, Fast Tracks, for some of you that may remember those previous programs. So we know that student outcomes have been positive over the last 2 years specifically regarding concurrent enrollment. We've seen a significant increase in the number of credentials that are attained by students within concurrent enrollment. Those have gone from a few hundred to almost 1,000. We've also continued to see percentages of courses passed continuously increase from in the mid-70s to now about 90% of students are passing all concurrent enrollment courses.
Wow.
So we've seen consistent improvement as we've been able to provide refinements in partnership with institutions of higher education as well.
The other thing I'll just add here is that part of the political interest in concurrent enrollment has to do with this data, right? That this is working to help kids earn college credit while they are in high school, and earning college credit while in high school changes the possibility and the likelihood that they will enroll in and persist in college afterwards. And so it is actually this set of data that is the reason that there is a lot of sort of policy conversation about this right now. People wondering if there are other meaningful things that can be done to expand access to this, given that it is one of the few things we really have found that, especially for underrepresented students, is making a significant difference in their college going and college persistence rates.
And it can save parents money.
And it saves parents money.
Right. Well, not only that, if we argue that we want all kids to attend college, the capacity is not in our bricks and mortar college programs.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to do that?
I don't want all kids to attend college.
Well, there are some folks who believe they want all kids to have some kind of a post-secondary mm-hmm. credential, degree, something. And we don't actually have the capacity in the state of Colorado if our kids wanted to go and qualify. That's mm-hmm. sort of a reality.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Sure. Quick question.
Yeah.
So what is the quality guarantee here? Only because among AP, IB, and Cambridge, the passing rate's between 40% and 50%,
mm-hmm.
whereas concurrent dual is 90%.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know that the rigor, because each course, if I understand correctly,
mm-hmm.
the rigor level is determined by the individual professor, including the end of course assessment. What quality guarantees do we have for concurrent enrollment?
I'll take a stab and then
sure.
So we have the same quality guarantees that any other course being offered at a higher ed institution has, mm-hmm. right? So there are courses approved by the Commission on Higher Education, which is the equivalent of this board for the higher ed set. And once they approve a course for a university to offer, that university offers that course, and that university is to vet the quality, right? So they determine whether the syllabus is adequate, whether the assessments are adequate. So it's the same mechanisms that do that for all college courses that are applied to this. You would have to ask higher ed, really, what they know about the degree to which there's variability
and
in those.
I don't want to put Gretchen on the spot, but there is, so among APIB Cambridge calculus courses, we have a 40% passing rate, but among college calculus courses, we have a 90, you know, mm-hmm. higher, 80 to 90. It's worth having that conversation with higher ed just to make sure it's of the rigor to make sure they're prepared for whatever course follows after that calculus one.
But that's the 2-year school dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
That the expectations, are not necessarily the same.
Yeah.
So I had students mm-hmm. that had the same textbook, but it was a 300 level course at Metro, and they had already aced it in the junior college, but they hadn't, mm-hmm. right? And I'd love to have somebody figure out how to solve that problem, but mm-hmm. we do not want universal accounting 351 assessments across mm-hmm. the state of Colorado, right?
Correct.
I will just add, for a totally different reason, actually, the Commission on Higher Ed is having conversations about comparability among those different measures right now, because they're looking at whether there should be a uniform policy across campuses about whether they give credit for a certain score on like an AP exam, whether that would be guaranteed. Right now, those standards vary by institution, and so interestingly, and for totally other reasons, the commission is actually having some conversation about that right now.
Been through that twice, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Great. The other factor, just to mention, is the accrediting body for the institutions of higher education themselves, or the Higher Learning Commission, and they have really chimed in and are looking deeply at concurrent enrollment. It's something that they're interested in, they're studying, so to be continued.
Mm-hmm.
This is a chart to give you deeper examples of the types of credentials that high school students have been graduating with over the past few years. We know this ranges from certificates and associate's degrees of applied science to associate's degrees leading into bachelor's degree work. So we know that we have seen a steady increase in all of these various types of credentials, and we anticipate at this point that this will continue. So these are students literally graduating with a high school diploma in one hand and a certificate and associate's degree in the other. So these are the types of different types of delivery options. You can see these pieces as mix and match. So all of these different three criteria are options that school districts have in order to offer concurrent enrollment and ways to blend these. So for example, school districts determine location. Is it going to be an online course? Is it going to be a course taught at the high school? Or is it going to be taught at the local community college? Is it going to be taught by an adjunct instructor from the community college at the high school, a high school teacher that has the credentials to teach that course and is then authorized to do so by the community college, or is it college faculty at the college? So there's lots of different ways to mix and match and creative solutions to complex challenges such as geographic challenges. The other piece is different types of courses, general education courses, career and technical education, or remediation, which I know that you're interested in as well, and we can talk more deeply about.
Yeah, hold on to that. It's coming later. Yeah. Just like two more slides, we'll get into remediation.
You said two-year colleges. It's not just two-year colleges.
It's so the primary colleges that are partnering with school districts are two-year colleges.
Really?
Some four-year colleges offer a small or minimal number of courses. There are a few, especially based on geography, that have a two-year. There are a few colleges that have a two-year and a four-year mission in our state, and so those four-year institutions are utilizing their two-year mission. So, for example, Adams State, Mesa, Colorado Mesa University, et cetera, that are able to offer a community college model as well as a four-year institution.
Well, if you can get to CU, you can go there and get credit.
And
right?
And if you have a cost agreement that makes that
well, that's
for your district,
that's what keeps worrying me.
Yeah.
And the same, I think, is probably true in Fort Collins and Greeley and any of the other places where there are four-year schools.
Yeah. So there is a program called Extended Studies that is outside of concurrent enrollment, and it's specifically operating outside of concurrent enrollment according to statute. So that typically is offered by a four-year institution. It's offered by their continuing education arm of their institution of higher education. And so it's basically offered as adults continuing community credit that may not be for credit and is not typically transferable.
Yeah. So the example I'm thinking of, because we've had, I think, more than one dual immersion program, once those kids get to high school, they've already had all the high school foreign language courses in the foreign language they're in, so they actually need to go to CU to get a higher level of that second language course. Mm-hmm. And that's not the adult education program. And the same is in the arts. I mean, that's been my experience that some of the, maybe not since it's changed, because I was no longer within the district, but there have been a fair number of kids, especially from Boulder High, because they just have to plunk up the pluck up the street. There were quite a few kids going to classes.
Right.
But they were paying, what you're saying, is, no, the district actually was paying.
So that would be a similar financial model then.
So,
Dr. Flores.
You know, this reminds me of, was it last time that we met, where the courses that CU taught in this were not credited by the other universities, and I don't understand. I didn't understand then, and I just wanted to ask the question, did I hear it correctly?
I think we're going to come to the remedial courses in a minute. I think that's what you're remembering.
No,
I don't even... Non-credit-bearing courses?
I don't think that remedial courses should be taught by a university. I thought, you know, I don't know why we... why a university would think about giving remedial courses in this, in an option like this.
So just to clarify what I believe you're referring to is the remediation piece is in partnership with two-year institutions, because you're correct that four-year institutions don't have the ability to provide remediation.
No, this one was that if kids take the courses at CU, they will not be credited by other universities in the state. But were they talking about remediation courses?
So
why would we be talking about kids taking remediation courses at the university level?
Two different topics.
Do they transfer? Yes.
Chairman Durbin, I believe, Val, what you're talking about the last time, it was we were discussing whether the, and it's in a law, you were in this meeting,
we were talking about legislative liaison.
It's a bill that says the high school has to inform the parents if it's a four credit or it doesn't transfer. So this is totally different from that particular conversation.
Mm-hmm. And the conversation about remedial we are going to get to in just a minute.
Okay.
Well, that I don't even understand.
Okay. One of the questions you had asked in January was around financial arrangements and financial agreements and how some of these models work. I will say that there are some consistent practices that are outlined in law that all school districts and institutions of higher education must follow. However, there is lots of room for flexibility. So I'll give you a few examples, and then if you have additional questions, we're happy to bring in districts or other folks to talk through their financial model information. One of the most common models that's really specific to the metro area between school districts and institutions of higher education is referred to colloquially as the 105% model. So what this means is that essentially the school districts get their PPR to pay for tuition, right? And then institutions of higher education get the College Opportunity Fund, which they get for all Colorado students, right? That pay the other portion of their tuition. So basically what happens in this model is it's a tuition neutral proposal for the school district, because essentially the institution of higher education has agreed to basically get the College Opportunity Fund and not charge additionally. That is unique to the metro area. Most commonly, the agreements are around either a discounted or the community college resident rate associated with any student that's a Colorado resident that would walk in the door and what that tuition might look like. There are other agreements where there are discounted fees for concurrent enrollment students, because what Colorado law says for concurrent enrollment is that districts must pay tuition. However, that leaves books, transportation, and fees still on the table that are difficult for many, many concurrent enrollment students and their families to afford. We're seeing fees that could equal tuition in some
colleges. May I just ask one quick question? Mm-hmm. So if a concurrent enrollment student goes from Colorado Springs Early Colleges and is enrolled at UCCS, which mm-hmm. they have an agreement, and I know they do, then is the institution of higher education eligible to capture a portion? Let's say they were enrolled for 6 hours, can they capture a portion of that funding that is given to the schools on a per pupil basis?
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. not full time, so they can get the full 2,000 whatever, but they would get, so they capture that portion of that funding, is that correct?
I think so, except that I don't think it's the way they determine the amount is not a proportion, it is a course cost. Right, so there's like a tuition cost,
right,
and the money that is the school's money, that's per pupil money, is given to that community college,
right,
based on their tuition rates and whatever their agreements are.
But I guess the question is, does the school also then capture additional state funds that would be, gosh, I'm trying to remember what they call those funds. I think you said.
Could the College Opportunity Fund?
Yes, okay, all right. Yes. College Opportunity Fund. Does, for example, UCCS capture that?
Correct.
they do on some sort of pro rata basis because it's not a full-time student.
Yes.
And then there's also a charge, a tuition. Is it a, do they charge the full per hour charge then back to Colorado Springs Early Colleges?
So that's a great clarification. The portion of per pupil revenue that school districts are capped at paying is resident community college tuition, basically minus the cost.
Even though that's not a community college, right?
Even though it's not community college. And so then the law says that parents can be asked to pay the difference.
ARG.
Between,
and fees? And student
fees,
which are really high at CU.
And books.
Yeah, student fees are a whole different issue. And mm-hmm. Fortunately, we're not in higher education to deal with it, but student fees can be oppressive.
Yeah. And then the institutions of higher education are receiving their portion of the College Opportunity Fund on a per-credit basis.
Yeah. I believe that the Center's King Schools, though, I don't believe parents make any payments there. Somehow he must be able to come up with the entire amount.
There are lots of creative models that districts have put in place or other things that they're negotiating mm-hmm. or other things such as fees and books where they're helping students with. And this is not consistent across the board, but some folks, some school districts have been able to cover some of those costs for some students.
This Thank is you. What troubles me. Is it a horrible task to find out what these fees are? Are we sure that a school doesn't make arrangement with one program and then charge something different, a different amount if there's a kid coming from another school because they don't have a contract? I mean, my understanding is that ESSA is going to provide some additional funds mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for low-income kids to be able to attend, but it would be really helpful if we actually knew what some of these arrangements are. And it might make this... Mm-hmm. parties feel a little more accountable, but I don't know if this would be a task that would just be overwhelming, or...
We do know some of this through school finance and their audits, because they audit based upon the contract between the college and then the district. We don't necessarily know all, but we can try to do our best to compare.
And then my second question is whether, to what extent we've reached the point with such... large participation, the districts are feeling like they can't take one more kid. I mean, that's the example I keep giving, that when I was in the school board, we really had to cut kids off because mm-hmm. we were out of money for them to take it, mm-hmm. the courses.
Yep.
And that was really troubling. And I don't know whether our districts are at that point and which ones are and which students are mm-hmm. are getting to participate and which ones are not.
Yeah. So I believe almost all districts, if not all, have some type of district policy where they limit the number of credits that a student can take for concurrent enrollment, and then it is up to the discretion of the district which students might have this opportunity. So again, we can do some general ask out to districts about what some of those policies might look like.
Yeah, I don't want to overwhelm you guys, mm-hmm. but I just think that we want to know, and I think maybe our legislature wants to know how this is working in terms of equity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that you're raising a lot of the same questions that we have heard in conversations across the street about this and why people are pursuing some legislation about this, right? There are, at a high level, people understand that it's effective, and then there are questions, which may not have terrible answers, but they're questions about whether there are any equity issues in terms of access to this system and whether something might need to be done to ensure equitable access, whether that's because it's rural or whether it's because it's a district of a certain size that maybe isn't rural but still can only offer it at a limited range. I think you're asking
the
same questions.
Or they decide to spend their money differently. You know, they want full-day kindergarten, so they're not going to offer as much concurrent enrollment.
Sure.
I mean, those are all choices
that are made.
They have huge impacts mm-hmm. on kids. And if we are going to be getting some more money, I'd want to think that to the extent that we may have inequities, that can help to address mm-hmm. those.
Okay, we're getting close to our hard stop. You guys
Let's
are doing
do it.
Fine.
I'm going to start talking faster. Look
You're
out.
Making great
it's
progress.
Happening.
He's very, very
okay,
helpful.
So this is the other map that you're not going to like, Dr. Schroeder. It's the other small map. And this is where we start the conversation about remediation. Oh,
sorry.
I don't have that map.
I'm sorry. It's in my copy and it's not yours.
Well, not if I can't read it.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Yeah, the colors are nice.
This is, so we wanted to give you some broader background on remediation in general, right, because there are some questions about that, and then we'll talk to this issue specifically of students in concurrent enrollment situations who take remedial courses. So first, just in the background here, this is a map just showing the percent of students per district who do enroll in post-secondary in our state and do require remediation. So if they're blue, it's fewer than 25% of their students requiring remediation when they get there. If they're green, it's 25 to 50%. And if they are yellow-orange, it's more than 50%. Wow. If a district is not labeled in color here, it's because the numbers they're sending are so small that by our end size rules, we can't report. Okay?
Yes.
So, Gretchen, just to that point, just to restate what I think I'm hearing, of the students that went to post-secondary, college or university.
Yep.
You've tied it back to their home district, the remediation rate.
Yes.
In-state, out-of-state, two-year, four-year. Doesn't matter.
I think this is all in-state.
So only those who sent students in-state.
Yeah.
So if they went out-of-state, we don't know about remediation rates.
Correct. Okay. Because, the National Clearinghouse doesn't report.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So these are kids that are taking advanced classes, but then they...
No, this is just anybody going to college. This is the big picture of remediation, so not having to do with concurrent enrollment.
Excuse me.
Just the big. So sorry.
That's the big picture on remediation.
This is the big picture of remediation.
It doesn't map.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. This slide is actually missing a key piece of information, so I'm just going to share it with you. So. Overall, for the whole state, everybody going to college in 13-14, our statewide remediation rate was 34%. This is a decrease of 3% from the year previous. And this note here about SAI, so supplemental academic instruction, is another one of the things that you'll hear the higher ed community talking about as something they have implemented that they think is positively impacting remediation rates. So essentially, this is a student in a credit-bearing course who is right alongside that getting additional academic supports rather than having to take the remedial course to get entrance to that credit-bearing course. And so I would say along with concurrent enrollment, this supplemental academic instruction is like the other thing that I hear the most about from higher ed about what they are doing that's having positive impact on kids doing well.
Mr. Chair and Gretchen, I don't how many of our higher ed institutions offer SAI?
So not all, but a handful, and this is the direction that the community colleges specifically are going, and then the more and more 4 years are signing on.
Okay, but out of our, how many higher ed institutions do we have in the state?
So there are 14 community colleges, and then about another 13 four-year institutions. And this doesn't include our for-profit institutions because there are 300 plus of those.
Yeah, there's a lot of those guys.
Or the nonprofits.
So out of 27, how many are using SAI?
So the community colleges.
All of them.
All 14.
All of them.
Okay.
And then, well, so 12 of the 14. And then about half of the 4 years.
It's growing. I mean, this has been a real focus for the Department of Higher Ed to try and support people in this, to research it, to help them see how effective it is. You know, there are resource implications for universities, right? So they've been helping them work through that and figure out how to do it. But then the specific question of concurrent enrollment students taking remedial courses. So this is the top bullet here. In concurrent enrollment, the only students who could take a remedial course are 12th grade students. Right now, of all the concurrent enrollment courses taken each year in the states, 6% of them are remedial courses, okay? And those are all only 12th graders. And the question that you asked about why would someone do that, I asked Misty, and I'm going to try to explain, and then Misty's going to correct me if I'm wrong. But there is a situation where a student could be in 11th grade, they take the ACT or eventually the SAT, and maybe they also take the Accuplacer, right? They're looking at community college entrance, and they don't score at a level in 11th grade that would let them into a credit-bearing course. When they come back as a 12th grader, if through concurrent enrollment they take the remedial course and they pass, they will not have to do remediation when they go to the college, right? So if their test scores would not get them out of remediation, taking that course while being a 12th grader would allow them to not have to do that remediation course and not have to spend the money on a non-credit bearing course when they went to college. So for the most part, for those, again, 6% of concurrent enrollment courses which are being taken by 12th grade students to be remedial courses, mostly that's why that's happening. Accurate?
Perfect. Excellent. So, and what's the funding on that?
Same as other concurrent enrollment courses. The district who has that kid pays the cost of their participation in that course and whatever their agreement is, just like any other course.
Which is what basically what some folks say, that the high school should pay for the remediation. I mean, that, there's always this...
There is that political commentary.
Political commentary. Yes.
I've had that comment. Ms. Rankin, did you have a comment?
That was my question.
Okay.
Just a comment. There's also bureaucracies at universities that just do that, remediation, to make money. I'm thinking of a private school that I worked at, a private university, and it was outrageous. I mean... Yeah.
Yes, Ms. Goff?
I think some of our state universities do the same thing.
Tangible info right now about how many of the higher ed, whether it's 4 years or community college, are doing this. Aren't they doing a concurrent SA5 program? Is that not kicked in fully yet for first-time students who may need some SAI, but they don't do it
separately? They're mm-hmm. supposed to be talking about working out plans where they can solve or actually satisfy both sets of credit at the same time. I don't know if anybody's kicked that in yet or not.
Yeah, so the SAI thing we were talking about before, that is happening, but it's for students who already have left the K-12 system. Mm-hmm. Right, so this is kids who are still in K-12 in their 12th year who are taking that remedial course to basically to deal with the fact that they didn't have a test score that would get them to that level when they went.
It may be too soon, too, for many K-12 communities as a whole to be really well informed about all of that right now. If the new admission standards don't start up until 21,
yeah, there's some time.
And graduation requirements tied in all that. So, yeah. But
Ms. Rankin, you had a.
How many students are we talking about when we talk about this remediation?
Well, 6% of all the courses. I don't know how many students that
6% of 20,000. So it's a few thousand students.
Yes. So how many kids are, how many juniors or seniors are taking the AccuPlacer?
Do you know how many are taking the AccuPlacer?
I don't know the exact number.
You could ask higher ed, but I don't know.
So what I wonder about is whether we've got students who are getting college credit for courses, and then they get to the 2 or 4 year school, they take the AccuPlacer, and they need to be remediated.
So that's one of the key pieces, in that if they take an 090 or the non-credit-bearing course before the 100 level, then they automatically go into the 100 level course.
That didn't make sense to me. Help me.
So
what's the 090 course?
So the course before, the non-credit-bearing course before
remediation course.
Yes. Remediation course before the credit-bearing course. If they pass that remediation course, then they're automatically put in 100 level.
Which is freshman.
They don't need to take the AccuPlacer. Right.
They step over their AccuPlacer.
Right.
Right.
But what causes them to take the 090 course?
It would be that the most common thing that they told us, again, would be that they didn't sufficiently perform on the tests that would have gotten them out of that course, so they take the remedial course to make up for the fact that they didn't get their through exam. So they would have maybe taken ACT or AccuPlacer, and it didn't get them to that level. They take this course so that when they fully enroll in that community college later, they are given automatic entry into the credit-bearing course, independent of their test scores.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't keep us from having kids go ahead and take 100-level courses while they're in high school.
No.
And still come back later on and have to face actually not being fully prepared in math and social and language arts.
In that case, I think you're talking about a situation where a student might, in high school, take a concurrent enrollment, a credit-bearing concurrent mm-hmm. enrollment course, like at a community college, mm-hmm. and then be given entrance into a more prestigious and competitive.
No, or the community college doesn't even have to be
recognized.
Because once you enter, that's when they check, right? Mm-hmm. It's once you matriculate that they have you take the assessment, the AccuPlacer, and mm-hmm. then you may not do well in the AccuPlacer.
If they've passed a credit-bearing course, though, would they be given
they wouldn't be placed below in remediation after?
So I think it depends.
There's a difference here between math and
yeah.
Right.
Remember, we know that most of the remediation is in math.
It's math, yeah.
So there's lots of math courses you could take.
Mm-hmm. It depends on the area of study and content areas of concurrent enrollment. So if I took a history course in concurrent enrollment, that doesn't mean that that takes me
your
out
math
of
profession.
Needing remediation for math and English.
Okay. Any other comments or anything in conclusion? How close? We're close?
We already made this quick note, but ESSA does speak to concurrent enrollment, and there will be some opportunities probably for us to have some support with this because of ESSA, so it's a nice change. And then the last quick advertisement I will give is that in partnership with higher ed, we convened a group of stakeholders to participate in a LEAN process. This is that's an acronym that I don't know what the letters mean. I'm sorry. But essentially, it's a process you use to make processes better. And we convened this group around concurrent enrollment because we have heard feedback that the registration process for this is difficult because there are these different the sort of deal a student might have at different institutions is different, and so those high school counselors are really having to broker a lot of things, and there isn't a unified way for that to happen. And so we gathered this group of people to ask about what would make it easier and better, and also what would allow us to expand. And so that group has made some recommendations. At some point, I think DHE will be sharing those with the legislature about it's things like, you know, have unified enrollment process. It's also things like find money for books. Because that's an access barrier for some students and some families. So I'm not going to go into detail there, but just I want you to be familiar with that so that if you hear about the results of a LEAN process on concurrent enrollment, you know that was something that we helped facilitate. We brought a lot of parents and students and K-12 people into that conversation as well as higher ed folks. So you may be hearing more about that as it informs the session. And that, sir, is it.
Thank you. All right, we're going to, everybody has plans this evening, and so thank you very much. We're going to adjourn, and we'll, any last-minute comments, anybody want to make any? We'll start tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.